Verse 25 of Matthew chapter 11. At that time, Jesus said, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you've hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this was your good pleasure. So none of what we'll take a look at today should be beyond us, because it's relatively elementary teaching on some of the most important things in life. He's revealing these truths, he says, to little children. All things, he says in verse 27, have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father. No one knows the Father except the Son and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. And then we have an imperative. This is a command. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. So it's an invitation to come, actually a command to come. And then there's an action that we're to be engaged in. There's something specific that we can do to enter into life. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. It is a yoke. It is a burden of sorts that we're asked to bear and submit to. But the promise is, number one, Christ will not harm us, for he's gentle and humble in heart. The second promise is, we'll find rest. We'll find what we've always looked for. And we'll be able to leave behind those things that have tormented us, where we've been wounded, perhaps sinned against, whatever it might be. This is an invitation to life. Willard would say, that this is an invitation to the impartation of life. So from Willard's perspective, as we'll see over the next 2 weeks, salvation is much more than the forgiveness of sin, though it surely entails the forgiveness of sin. Salvation, redemption, regeneration, all these great words of the cross and the resurrection, at its core is the impartation of life to us as embodied selves. Now write that word, that phrase out for me. As embodied selves. Because Willard's thesis is this, is that the human body itself, next 2 weeks are going to be on the human body's relationship to spiritual formation, that the human body itself, your body and my body, can actually become a vehicle that God uses to impart life to us. So God's not simply dealing with our souls. You ever hear that expression? We're going to, probably out of the revival movement in the 19th century, we're going to save souls tonight. Now, what we're going to save are embodied selves who have a soul, but they also have a body. And what Willard is insistent upon is that it's as we use our body in a particular fashion, we're more deeply formed and shaped into the image of Christ. But we have to choose to do so. Discipleship for Willard is a choice. So, for example, if you take a look here, the secret of the easy yoke. Just turn to chapter 1, page 1. The secret of the easy yoke. So, that's interesting. This is something that's a kind of secret. It's not immediately apparent. See, people have read Matthew chapter 11, verse 29 for years, and in some way have been comforted by it, but also troubled by this question, how do I actually put that yoke on? Now that's a metaphor. That's the metaphor of the yoke is a metaphor of discipleship, to be a follower of Christ. And Christ says, to be a follower of Christ, you've got to allow me to teach you. You have to allow me to teach you. You have to allow me to show you how to put that yoke on so that you can live like I live. He's still alive today, so that you can live like I live as I impart my life to you. But I'm going to impart my life to you in your body. It's not as though I'm simply interested in your soul. I'm interested in you, and I've created you with the very same kind of body that I myself have. Christ today is seated at the right hand of the Father, wherever that is, but he's got a body. He didn't leave his body behind. Someday you'll see hands with holes in those hands. You'll see feet with holes in those feet. There'll be a scar in his side. He still has that body. So ask yourself this question. We've done this before in here. Maybe journal about it. You know, what have I done with my body? Now, most of you are between 18 and 23. I am not interested in reading this myself. So staple it shut, but have that body exercise in there, that body history exercise. And I think this will help us to make sense out of what Willard's trying to teach us. What have I done with my body? What are the choices I've made in terms of very specific things? You might think about what have I chosen to eat and how much over the years? Or what have I chosen not to eat? How have I used my body in terms of how I behave sexually? How have I chosen to dress my body? I mean, just what are those specific choices I've made over the years? I've made them as an embodied self. I have made these choices, and I've used my body to carry out those choices. And what's the result been in terms of my character? Now remember, we've talked about character in here, and what I've argued is that our character, who I am as a person, is largely the result of the choices that I've chosen to make over time, and as those choices have become habituated in my body, that's who I am, right? We clear on that? So this link between habit formation and spiritual formation and the choices we make in our bodies is an immediate one. Now, if you take a look at page one of Willard's book, he mentions Bonhoeffer. And we've talked some about Bonhoeffer in here. Bonhoeffer, of course, the call to discipleship is the call to change. And Bonhoeffer wrote a well-known work called The Cost of Discipleship. And there is a cost involved in discipleship. There have to always be certain yeses and certain noes when it comes to discipleship. Willard's point, however, is that there's an equally high cost when it comes to non-discipleship. It's not like there's some kind of neutral ground that we can occupy as though, well, I won't be a disciple, but I won't not be a disciple. As though there's some neutral ground. It's one or the other. And whatever the choice is, yes, I will be a disciple, a learner, or no, I won't be a disciple or a learner. Those are the only two I can see that we've got. There's no middle territory there. And some people will back away from this call to discipleship because they'll think, you know, it's going to cost me too much. It'll be too much to give up. It's going to be too hard. I'd rather stay where I am. Now listen to Willard here. This is a second paragraph in chapter one. I think the page numbers you've got in your book are the one that I have in this older edition. So this is page one. He said, the second paragraph on page one, we would do far better to lay a clear, constant emphasis upon the cost of non-discipleship as well. That's a great journaling exercise, by the way. It's tough, but it's good. You might ask yourself the question, all right, what have I paid? What kind of bills have I paid by saying no rather than yes? There's always bills. What's it cost me to say no? Christ clearly saying, this is the way to life, and for one reason or another, as we all have done, we saying, no, I think this is the way to life, or I really need this right now. Well, what's the cost been? Well, his point here is Soren Kierkegaard reminds us, it costs a man just as much or even more to go to hell than to come to heaven. Narrow, exceedingly narrow, is the way to perdition. Now, note this text, Proverbs 13:15. Proverbs 13:15 tells us that it's the way of the transgressor that's hard. Sin is very, very hard. Just beats the heck out of you. It's very hard. It's not easy. Has a cost. We can, and Willard comments, we can also learn this by candid observation of life. Actually, a large part of the Old Testament book of Proverbs merely records the results of such observation. The whole book is a song of praise for the path of the righteous over that of the wicked, leaving no doubt in which life, joy, and strength are to be found. Now remember that righteousness is not the ability to follow a long list of rules. Remember that? Righteousness is a relationship word. The righteous person simply knows how to live and knows what's called for in a given relationship and behaves accordingly. I think the illustration I used in class was you as students and me as professors. If I teach well and you work hard, we'll have a righteous relationship together. If I'm a knucklehead or you're not working hard, then we have an unrighteous relationship. So that you can describe a righteous relationship when it comes to marriage. You can righteous relationship when it comes to relationships between parents and children. Righteous relationship between a human being and government, or unrighteous. All kinds of relationships that the Old Testament and New Testament scripture talks about. Now listen to this paragraph. This is quite telling. Next paragraph. To depart from righteousness, then, as I've described it, to depart from righteousness is to choose a life of crushing burdens, failures, and disappointments, a life caught in the toils of endless problems that are never resolved. Ever feel like that? Here is the source of that unending soap opera, that sometimes horror show, known as normal human life. The cost of discipleship, though it may take all we have, is small when compared to the lot of those who don't accept Christ's invitation to be part of his company in the way of life. All right, so that's the first principle for today. It costs you just as much not to follow as to follow. In fact, Willard argues that it costs more. And the goal is this. The goal is simply to be able to live as he lived. That's the goal. The goal is to be able to live as he lived with that kind of power and love and wisdom manifest in a human being's life. I know it sounds outrageous to say that the first time, to live as Jesus Christ lived, and perhaps even to do some of the things that Jesus Christ did. But that's Willard's belief. He believes that we are created to live like Christ. Now, here's the point. We cannot live as Christ lived, manifesting that kind of love and power unless we adopt his form of life. Because he himself, though God incarnate, he was not a divine computer. In fact, the writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews says that Jesus learned to obey. He learned to obey. How did Jesus learn the scripture? I think he went to synagogue. He went to synagogue and he heard the rabbis preaching and he memorized probably from an early age, page after page after page of scripture. He was especially gifted. The rabbis noticed him and they noticed his gifting and his wisdom and ability. But he's going to synagogue. He's going up to the temple. He's learning as the years go on. Luke tells us this. He's learning who his father is. Can you imagine what it'd be like to go up to the temple and, watch the lambs being slaughtered on the day of Passover and realizing that you are the Lamb of God who has come, is that final sacrifice, and maybe you're 13, 14, 15, and you're getting nudged by the Holy Spirit, that there's something very special about you and your life and what you're called to do. It'd be quite something. But the point is this. He was able to do the things he was able to do, yes, because of who he was, but also because of the manner of life in which he chose to live. You know all these empirical studies we took a look at? And they show that human beings are self-centered and self-serving, and almost every one of them demonstrated that we have a hard time facing the truth about ourselves. There are some tests, some empirical tests, that show that Christians are different. Christians are different, some of these tests show. Because I can remember when I was teaching foundations about, gosh, it was 16 years ago. My goodness gracious, there was about 20 students in the class. And he wouldn't mind me mentioning his name, Barclay, you're now on film, a student named Barclay Wyckoff. And I could tell when I was going through those empirical studies, Barclay was so upset. He was just looking mad. So finally I said, Barclay, what are you so angry about? Dr. Hall, you're presenting slanted studies. Surely Christians are different. He didn't quite yell like that, but he was fairly animated. And so I said, well, you know, Barclay, you know when we're different? Is when we take pencil tests. For example, when a sociologist would give us a test, we know what the right answers are. So at that point, we show up as different. You know when we're not different? When we don't know we're being studied. When we don't know we're being studied, when you got some mean-spirited sociologist who's setting us up, and he hasn't told us he's studying us, that's when the differences disappear. That's why I got to ask you this really tough question with a preceding comment. We are really like what we're like when we think no one is watching. That's when the truth of the matter rises to the surface. And that's when sociologists, when they do studies of Christian folk, and they've set, for example, they have set up students, I don't mean to pick on students at Wheaton College, but they've set up students at Wheaton College. For example, once there was one study by a sociologist, and he set up Wheaton students who were on their way to a Bible study. And there was some, this was all set up, but there was some poor soul with what looked like a broken ankle howling in pain by the side of the road. And the vast majority of students passed by on the other side because they had to get to the Bible study. And the students were upset afterwards. You set us up. His response, I just wanted to see what you acted like when nobody was watching. So now here comes the tough question. What are you like when nobody's watching? Ouch. Be tough on me too. What are you like when nobody's watching? So the goal would be, see, the goal is to become like Christ, and we become like Christ by practicing. This is key now. This is kind of the next 2 weeks. We become like Christ in terms of the ability to love and respond spontaneously to whatever God and God's providence brings into our lives. We become like Christ by practicing the very same disciplines he practiced. Disciplines such as prayer, silence, solitude, meditation, service, worship, celebration, simplicity. The very same means that he, as an embodied self, used, we're called to use. Take a look. If you would take a look at page 3 of Willard's book. Now I'm going to go down to 1, 2, 3, 4. Fourth paragraph on page 3. I want you to go back and look at this text for me, okay? Think of certain young people who idolize an outstanding baseball player. They want nothing so much as to pitch or run or hit as well as their idol. So what do? When they're playing in a baseball game, italicized, when they're playing in a baseball game, they all try to do exactly as their favorite baseball star does. Now, this is true, and I know it's true, because I saw my nephew behaving in such a fashion. My nephew is Spencer Hall. He's from Paraguay. And he looks like a little Latin American baseball player, although he's grown since the time I saw him do what I'm going to describe to you. But Spencer has always, he lives down in Richmond. He's always loved the Atlanta Braves because their farm team, Richmond Braves, is in Richmond. And so I went to a baseball game of his, and this is the level above T-ball. You know what T-ball is? You got that thing on and you put a ball on top and the kid whacks it and runs like crazy backwards around the bases and doesn't know what he's doing. And everybody laughs. All right, so this is the next level up. Now Spencer has obviously been watching Maddox when Maddox pitched for the Braves. So this is the next level up. For example, on this level, the pitcher is actually pitching the ball. That's Spencer. But there's no stealing. You can't steal a base. Are you with me? You can't steal. So if the runner gets the first base, he just has to stand there till some kid actually gets lucky and hits the ball. All right, now this is Spencer. He's been watching Maddox. He's going to look like a little Luis Dion. And so he walks out to the mound with a glove under his arm. And he just kind of walks out. And then he takes the baseball up off the ground. And by the way, he starts spinning. So spinning on himself. He hasn't really learned how to spit yet, but he's spitting. And then he's rubbing this baseball, because his baseball is a little slippery. You know, he's going to be firing it in there. So he's rubbing the baseball. And then finally, and then he puts his foot on the rubber like he's going to go into the stretch. Why would you do that? The runner can't run. But and then he starts looking over at the runner. Like that. Like, don't go anywhere. He can't go anywhere, but he's looking over here. And then he looks in at the catcher, and he's waiting for the sign. The poor catcher's thinking, I'm afraid, I'm just learning how to catch a baseball. Just please throw it to me. Just throw it to me. Let me catch it. I don't want to be embarrassed in front of my parents, please. Spencer's not going to do that. So he keeps waiting. I mean, this is prolonged. We're talking 2-3 minutes. He's waiting. He's spitting. He's a mess. He's looking over here. And so finally, he goes into the stretch. He's done everything that Maddox would do, but a little bit slower. And then he launches that baby like a hand grenade. And it just goes, boom, about 5 feet short of the plate. But he is so good. He just acts like that's normal. Give me the ball back. Give me the ball back. Starts rubbing the baseball again. My nephew. Now, what's the problem? What's the problem? He was in the game, trying to do what Maddox would do in the game, or if you change the metaphor, what Michael Jordan would do in the game. But his body wasn't prepared to do what his mind was telling his body to do. He just, in his case, he simply wasn't old enough. He hadn't practiced enough. Now, take a look at Willard. What Willard does here, he asks the question, will they succeed, bottom of page 3, will they succeed in performing like the star, though? We all know the answer quite well. We know that they won't succeed if all they try to do is to be like him in the game. So back in the 19th century, there was a movement. And even in the 20th century, we had those bracelets, right? WWJD. What would Jesus do? Now, those are great. What would Jesus do? It's a good question, but it's not enough. How do you learn how to do what Jesus would do is the question that Willard poses. See the difference? You know, can reading the New Testament be discouraging sometimes? You look at the life of Christ, and he's raising people from the dead. He's feeding 5,000 people. He's walking on water. He's filled with all this wisdom and so on and so forth. And then someone says, what would Jesus do? And we feel like, you know, that's not fair. Stop it. What would Jesus do? Son of God. I'm not God incarnate. I'm a fallen sinner. I'm just trying to make it through the day. And Willer's point is, now, wait a minute. Maybe there are at least some things that we could do, learning to love God and neighbor, learning to obey rather than sin. Maybe there's some things that we could learn to do if we didn't say simply, well, what would Jesus do, but ask the question, how did he learn how to do what he did and does as an embodied self? Are you with me? Does that make sense? There's a big difference between the two. So maybe learning to love your enemy is something you learn how to do, perhaps by practicing a specific spiritual discipline. Maybe learning to live a chaste life sexually is something you learn how to do. Don't you get just frustrated with somebody who says, stop it? And you really want to stop, but everything in your body is saying, I want to do it. With me, self-indulgent personality, someone says, stop eating so many donuts. I say, oh, I know I probably should stop because my heart's going to stop beating. But I don't know how to stop because for 25 years, every time I drive past Dunkin' Donuts, give me a frosted chocolate, please. In fact, I'll take two. So now, what have I done to my body? What have I done to my body? Every time I see the DD, my body says, need a donut. Need it. Need it right now. And I've learned through a habituated behavior to stop, buy, eat, be fulfilled, die. See, I'm thinking, maybe if we learn how to pray, anybody ever teach you how to pray? If we learned how to pray, maybe life would be different. If we learned how to study well, maybe like Christ studied, life would be different. If we learned how to fast, especially for those of us in here who have that particular struggle with a self-indulgent personality, maybe if we learned as a community, I don't know, how to fast, life would begin to make more sense. Jesus, at the beginning of his ministry, spent how many days in the wilderness fasting? 40 days. Why did he do that? Well, maybe he did that so that he'd be able to do many of the things he did when he came out of the wilderness back into his relationship with all those people who are going to ask so much of him. That's Willard's point. That's Willer's point. Let's take a look at the Apostle Paul for a minute. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Note the text if you don't have a Bible. 1 Corinthians 9, starting with verse 24. Do you not know, Paul writes, do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. So it's an athletic metaphor. Now, underline verse 25. Everyone who competes in the games goes into what? See it? Into strict training. Has anybody ever said to you, you know, to live life well as a disciple of Christ might require strict training. Strict training. So that not only do we receive information in our minds, but the way we behave actually changes. Concretely changes. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last. Now see that demonstrative pronoun, it? What's it refer to? Anybody, what does it refer to?
Training.
Strict training. Now, what Paul's saying here is the same principle applies to people who are embodied selves. Strict training. So it shouldn't surprise us that if over the past 5 or 10 years I've been living a blithely wild sexual life, and then I come into the kingdom and Christ says, you know, we got to get sane in terms of how we're behaving sexually, that everything within me is screaming out against the possibility of me ever doing that because I haven't gone into strict training yet. I haven't learned how to do it. Take a look here. He says, they do it to get a crown that will not last. But we do it, strict training. We do it. So he's exhorting the Corinthians to go into strict training to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, he says, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I don't fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. Now, he's speaking in terms of the metaphor. He's not calling us to become masochists, but he is saying this. He's saying it's deeply naive to think that a human being can change. It's deeply naive, spiritually speaking, deeply naive to think that a human being can change and ignore what he or she has done, is doing, and will do with their bodies. You with me? Deeply naive. And deeply discouraging. Man, I can't tell you, you know, when I was a old Jesus freak, so back in the late 60s, early 70s, whenever I came into the kingdom of God, I had so many people, God bless them, they saved me. I had so many people who could tell me how to get saved. Ask Jesus into your heart. All right? I'll ask Jesus into my heart. He forgave all your sins. Oh, that's good. Love it. Because there's a long list. Nothing better than that. And then, all right, what's next? And it was at the what's next stage that people were oftentimes silent. They would say things like this, all right, Chris, you're not supposed to get drunk. Oh, all right. And you're not supposed to sleep with women you're not married to. Oh, okay. And, you know, a laundry list of, you know, this is how you're supposed to behave and this isn't what you're supposed to be doing, right? Well, I'm thinking, all right, how do you do it? And it was at the how point that things broke down. Because at that time, most people were not familiar with these classical spiritual disciplines that Christians had practiced for years. You with me? They weren't. I wanted someone to tell me, all right, if I've been doing A and B and C for years and my behavior is supposed to change, how am I supposed to do it? Hello, help me out a little bit. And at that point, I tended to get blank stares. I'd hear a commandment. I'd hear an exhortation. But I needed help. I needed a coach. Now, see, that's why it's so key to immerse ourselves in Christ's life, to watch what he does so he's prepared to act almost, it seems, instantaneously as God, is, his Father, is calling him to act in the given situation. Let me show you. Turn over to Luke. I think we've talked about this before. If not, good. If I have, doesn't matter. So turn over to Luke chapter 5. Now, this is a perfect example how the gospel writers will sprinkle into these texts clues in terms of how Jesus himself conducted his spiritual life. You know, you might write that down. How did Christ himself conduct his own spiritual life? How did he go about it? What did he do? Look at Luke here, verse 12 of Luke chapter 5. While Jesus was in one of the towns, a man came along who was covered with leprosy. It's very dramatic. So suddenly he's facing a situation he probably wasn't expecting for that day. And here walks up to him a man who's covered with leprosy, some kind of skin disease, a man who's been ostracized in Israel probably for years. In fact, this man had to walk along the road shouting out, unclean, unclean, so that other Israelis or other Jews would know to stay away from him. When he saw Jesus, he fell with his face to the ground and begged him, Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean. So that there's a certain tension in the narrative. Question becomes, what's Jesus going to do? So look what he does in verse 13. He knows what to do. He knows not only does the man need to be healed, but if all his life, think of how quickly Christ thought this out. If all his life he'd been hearing people scream at him, unclean, unclean, and he's having to call out to warn people, unclean, unclean, what does Christ do? Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. He knew what to do. He touches the man, and by touching him, he himself becomes ritually unclean. But it doesn't bother him. And then power goes out from Jesus. Power. And immediately, the leprosy left him. So we have power going out, and secondly, Jesus knows what to do when he's suddenly confronted with a situation. Are you with me? He knows what to do. Now, Luke's point is, he knows what to do because of verse 15 and 16. Now, look at the text with me. Yet the news about him spread all the more, so that crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses. Now see the crowds. They're surrounding Jesus. And they're calling out like this man called out, heal me, save me. Lord, help me. Now look what Luke writes in verse 16. Now this is how Jesus did it. Look at verse 16. But Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. See what Luke juxtaposed? Remember that. He juxtaposes Jesus' ministry with Jesus' preparation for that ministry. Jesus, Luke says, often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. That's God incarnate. Now, Willard's question would be this. How much more so do we need to withdraw to lonely places and pray in our much more troubled condition? Why? So that we will have power. So that we will be able to love safely and sanely. If God incarnate, God embodied, found it necessary to often withdraw into solitude and silence and prayer, how much more so we? That's Willard's point. That's one of his main points. Because we are embodied just as Christ was embodied. So let me ask you a question. I do not ask this question to make you feel guilty. I don't want you to feel guilty. But just to raise the point. How often do you withdraw into silence and solitude and prayer? Is it a rhythm in your life? If it's not, I think Jesus would teach this in Willard, if it's not a rhythm in your life, things won't make sense spiritually. Just as simple as that. If it's not a rhythm in your life, you probably will have trouble loving other people. If it's not a rhythm in your life, you'll probably have difficulty leading a chaste life. If it's not a rhythm in your life, you'll probably have struggles about spending money wisely. If it's not a rhythm in your life, you'll eat too many donuts. Or you won't eat enough. If it's not a rhythm in your life, we'll probably be afraid when we don't need to be afraid, anxious when we don't need to be anxious, worried when we don't need to be worried, angry when we don't need to be angry, unable to forgive when he asks us to forgive, if we don't follow the patterns he himself followed. It's such a key point. That's why I'm kind of just slowing down here. It's absolutely key. That's why I want to encourage you, if you're just getting started, dive into the Gospels. Just swim in that water. Swim there. To mix metaphors, just breathe the air of that human being's life, because it's God incarnate. And ask yourself the question. See how Luke just kind of dropped that into that text? It's the kind of thing we just read, yeah. Let's get to the healing. And he's saying, no, the healing, the power, the insight came from somewhere. It didn't arise out of a vacuum. It came from Christ's own immersion in silence, in solitude, and in prayer. Apart from this, nothing. This is the sine qua non. That's a Latin phrase that means apart from this, nothing. This is the sine qua non of spiritual formation. It's not asking simply what does Jesus do when he does some of the spectacular things he does. It's asking the question, what did he do in order to do that? See the difference? What did he do in order to do that? Did Jesus fast? Yeah, on a regular basis. Did Jesus study the scripture? Yeah, on a regular basis. Did Jesus pray? Did Jesus lead a simple life? Did Jesus know how to spend what little money he had? Did Jesus know how to, you know? That's the point. That's the point. So, remember what I said last class about first and second things? The illustration I used last class about first and second things, Lewis's principle, had to do with hedonism, but it's equally applicable to what we're talking about in terms of Jesus. So hedonism is the pursuit of pleasure as a first thing, if you remember, right? And what I argued last class was that pleasure itself is a derivative value. Pleasure is a derivative value. It's a second thing found in the pursuit of what? A first thing. And the illustration I gave from last class was work. That in this hierarchy of values, work would be a first thing, and then do it as a result of a strenuous exertion, the pleasure comes. But the principle works of first and second things works in terms of what we've been saying about Christ. For Christ, a first thing would have been 40 days fasting. I'm not suggesting that anybody here tries to fast for 40 days, by the way. We'll talk about fasting later this semester. A first thing for Christ was his relationship with his Father, as Luke teaches us. And then the second thing was the ability to love. The ability to know what to do and how to do it when the situation presented itself. A man running up to him, calling out, "Save me from my leprosy." And his ability, catch it? His ability to respond came out of his pursuit of those first things. All right, you can journal about this. Ask yourself the question, what are the first things he is calling me to pursue actively, strenuously? Like an athlete learning how to sprint. What are the first things? Second question, have I been pursuing second things as first things? It'll never work. It'll blow up in your face. It'll blow up in your face. Won't work. Maybe that's the way to determine whether we've been putting second things in the place of first things. All right? Now, moving on here. So, just by way of review, so we've talked about how we can choose to be a disciple or not to be a disciple. Willard says we can choose to sin or not to sin. There's no neutral ground. It's one or the other. Moving on. I'd really like you to think this one through. And let's stay with the metaphor of an athlete. What might he be asking you to practice? Like the Phillies down in spring training right now. And they're doing all kinds of funny things that don't have any, looks like they don't have anything to do with baseball. Have you seen the photographs in the paper? Ryan Howard had a medicine ball, of all things, their first baseman. He's holding this medicine ball up and he's rolling it around in his hands. Well, he's never going to use that medicine ball in a baseball game. But it has to do with preparation for playing first base or for swinging a bat well. What might Christ be asking you to begin to practice that you're not practicing now? So that if later today someone walked up to you or you encountered a situation through God's providence, you'd know what to do and would possess the insight and love and power to be able to respond. Let's keep going here. Now take a look at page 13. Okay? Do you have this text? All right, let me read this out loud. Go back over to page 12, bottom of the page. He says, as a result, we find ourselves on the horns of a dilemma. There's been a discussion going on whether Christians can actually stop sinning. You think you can stop sinning? Well, let's think of it this way. How have we been doing the last minute? Last 30 seconds. I would bet there was some of you. I'm looking at your faces. I would bet there was some of you who for the last 30 seconds you did not sin. 30 seconds, a minute, an hour. Who knows what's possible? But this was an active debate going on amongst some students, and Willard is using that debate to make a point. He says at the bottom of page 12, note these page numbers if you don't have the book. As a result, we find ourselves caught on the horns of a dilemma. If one day I assure my Christian friends that I intend to quit sinning, actually, if you walked into a residence hall at Easter, that would really get a discussion going, wouldn't it? You walk in and you're a lacrosse player and all the other lacrosse players are there, or you're whatever, and you say, you know what? I intend to stop sinning. How do you think people would respond? Right, you little hypocrite. Right, you self-righteous so-and-so. Right, it's not possible. Well, anyway, if one day I assure my Christian friends that I intend to quit sinning and arrive at a stage where I can perfectly follow Jesus Christ, they'll most likely be scandalized and threatened, or at least very puzzled. Who do you think you are? They would probably say, or they might think, what's he really up to? But if, on the other hand, I state that I don't intend to stop sinning, it seems like that's the only other alternative. If I state that I don't intend to stop sinning, or that I don't plan ever to follow my Lord in actual, what does it say here? I got it. In actuality, they'll be equally upset. And for good reason. Would that really differ in substance and outcome from not having him as my Lord at all? What did Jesus say? If you love me, you will what? If you love me, you'll obey me. My Christian fellowship circle will allow me not to follow him and even not to plan to follow him, but they will not permit me to say it. Yet, now here's the overhead. Yet, I must do one or the other. Either I must intend to stop sinning or not intend to stop. There is no third possibility. I must plan to follow Jesus fully or not to follow him. But how can I honestly do either? It's a good question, isn't it? And does not planning to follow him really differ before God and humanity from planning not to follow him? Now, the next paragraph is what we've talked about for about a half hour, so note it. The dilemma would be dissolved if we could realistically plan to be like Christ. I want you to think that through with me. Planning to be like Christ. What's the game plan? How would that happen? Perhaps the most difficult of moments in a minister's or teacher's life occurs when, in response to his own sincere preaching or teaching, a listener says, like when I was a Jesus freak, all right, I really do want to be like Christ. You've convinced me that it's only as I walk with him and become really like him that I can know the fullness of life for which I was created. Next line. Now, tell me precisely how to go about it. The leader can hardly say, oh, you shouldn't really try to do that. On the other hand, it's the rare leader or teacher today who could calmly say, here's how you do it. But isn't that encouraging, the possibility that we might actually learn how to do it, where it becomes almost second nature, and then life makes sense? Like that, it's almost like that gene therapy I've talked about that just kind of flows into our bloodstream. Next point. Now, this is almost a self-evident truth, but you cannot believe how Greek we can be. Again, thinking that the area of a human being where God really works is on a human being's spirit. And that things that are spiritual have to do with the spirit and not the body, as though the body is in some way a hindrance to spirituality, a hindrance to spiritual growth and development. And Willard, asterisk, 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 Willard says, no, we're embodied selves, and the body can actually be a vehicle that God uses to change us. It doesn't have to be a hindrance. It depends on what we've taught it over time, how we've habituated it. Because sometimes, is it not true? I mean, sometimes it seems like our body is saying, oh, man, you need it, and you need it now. You need it now so bad you want to scream. Well, there's a reason why our body is saying that. We trained it in some way to say that. So the possibility exists of reversing the process. Take a look at page 18. As I now see it, Willard writes, and as we will discuss, the gospel preached and the instruction and example given these faithful ones simply do not do justice to the nature of human personality as embodied incarnate. Now, he's critiquing a certain way of preaching the gospel. You can read about that on page 18. Now, look at the next paragraph and circle it. Or tell yourself, go back, first paragraph, page 19. By contrast, the secret of the standard historically proven spiritual disciplines is precisely that they do respect and count on the bodily nature of human personality. Let me ask you this question. If, say, you're from a church tradition where you're not used to kneeling, and say you go to church with me and we go up to Good Sam, and for the first time in your life, with your body, you kneel and confess your sin. Lord, I confess that I've sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, what I've done, what I've left undone. But you use your body. Think that would make a difference? Think that would teach you something about prayer, sin, forgiveness, who God is, who you are? Or think of it this way. Sometimes we can use our bodies in other ways that are helpful. I, for instance, when I was a new believer, was just terribly self-conscious. I was kind of like, don't look at me. Don't talk to me. I'm in church trying to figure this out. Leave me alone. Well, there's a lot going on here. And over the years, the Lord finally said, I think, all right, now we got to get beyond this self-consciousness. And I think the way I'm going to help you to do this is with your body. So I was in a very conservative church where they're not using their bodies a heck of a lot. You kind of come in, you sit down, there's a sermon, you sing a few songs, and you leave. But your body's not really involved too much. But the pastor on this day started talking about the body. It was very interesting, man, listening, and he was talking about raising your hands in worship. God forbid, never will I ever, someone might watch me. They'd look at me. I misunderstood what he was saying. There was a certain point in the sermon where I thought what he said was, all right, if you're struggling with this, I want you to stand and raise your hands. I thought that's what he meant. So I thought, well, I'm going to close my eyes, and I'm going to stand and just raise my arms. So there's about 300 or 400 people there. And so I closed my eyes, I stood up, and I raised my hands like this. And I thought, yeah, that's not too bad. There's probably a lot of people standing up right now, raising their arms. You know, this is kind of a way to use my body, just to kind of walk in the presence of God in my life. So this is pretty good. And then they were singing, you know, and I'm kind of swaying back and forth. And then I thought, I wonder how everybody else is doing. So I looked around. I am the only one. I am the only one standing, waving my arms around like a fish, if fish had arms. And I sat down, and I could have been mortified, I suppose, but I was kind of chuckling to myself. And then I said, Lord, was that really necessary? Was that really necessary? But you know what? I still remember it. I still remember it. I used my body. And using my body in such a fashion kind of broke something within me. Well, I became, you would have thought, I will never ever go to church, much less stand up and wave my arms. But what it did was it showed me there was something that God probably found pleasurable in that lack of self-consciousness. God might have taken pleasure in that, you knucklehead. You used your body. And something was learned. So ask yourself this question. Are there, you know, take a look, for example, take a look at Richard Foster's, what's that book called? Celebration of Discipline. Take a look at the different spiritual disciplines he talks about in there. Don't try to read it right now, but he lists them. Everyone will ask you to use your body in some way. So ask yourself the question, all right, which of these particular disciplines that will engage my body might help me to get over the hump with a certain habituated behavior that's really harming me rather than helping me? How can I use my body differently? Because human personality is embodied. Keep going here. That makes sense now, doesn't it? It's almost like a self-evident truth. Now catch it, though. If spiritual growth depends on using our bodies in a given fashion, I would think that spiritual growth and formation would also entail certain no's. No, I can no longer use my body like that because it's taking the body and using it in such a way that spiritual formation and growth is hindered rather than helped. So take a look. Page 20 for that one. Moving on here. Now, the chapter 3 really contains a lot of what I've taught today. So what I would like you to do for next class is to go back and read chapter 3 now. In light of what we've talked about today, go back and read chapter 3. I think it will make more sense. In light of what I've said today, what questions do you have that I can we can work on? We've got a few minutes.
Can you just go over the concept of first and second things again? Just give me another like lifelike example I could.
So we have this the concept of first and second things. All right, I'm not asking you this question, but I'm tossing this out at the class. Is the pursuit of sexual pleasure, which is created by God, right? We all have nerve endings. So sexual pleasure, is the pursuit of sexual pleasure a first or a second thing? Hugh Hefner, publisher of Playboy, Hugh Hefner would argue it's a first thing. It's a first thing. I would say, no, it's not a first thing, it's a second thing that blossoms within the context of a higher value. And I would illustrate that. If you remember from last class, that couple I saw dancing at Christmas, now they were holding each other. And the way they were holding each other, you just knew they had 50 years of just wonderful experience together. They loved each other's bodies. That makes sense to me. Doesn't it make sense to you? But that pleasure, that embodied pleasure, was not derived from pursuing it directly. It was derived from a higher value. That's a first thing. And the higher value is two people saying to each other, I love you. I'm thinking a wedding ceremony. I love you, and I promise I will never leave you. And then you start getting to know one another, and you have the honeymoon, and sometimes it's great, and sometimes it blows up in your face, but you promised each other, I love you, and I'm not going to leave you. And over time, things begin to move into your marriage by God's grace. It's not always the case, but by God's grace, and sexual pleasure blossoms within a higher value. Two people saying to one another, I'm with you for the long haul. So that's first and second things. You can pursue second things as first things. But what will happen is they'll tend to snap finally. Or you'll become increasingly hollow rather than increasingly human. Which I would argue, you know, it looks to me has happened to Hugh Hefner. When you think about how many women he's had relationships with, and almost every relationship finally blows up. It's probably in the hundreds. I think there's a reason why. All right, I can tell from your body language you want to go, so I'll see you on Thursday. You got a quiz on Thursday. Study hard.